Ooh, glory. Have I set a test date?
No.
May 12th. Okay. I think I'll give my wife the test tomorrow, and we'll see how she does, and then let me know how long a time I should give the class. Today's the 27th, huh? Well, when do you want it?
How about
the 5th, Tuesday, a week from tomorrow? We'll take it on Tuesday, correct it on Wednesday, then it won't be the last day, last couple of days. Wouldn't you rather have that? Okay, so we'll take it on the 5th.
I think you're in the wrong mess.
It takes about 4 hours to take, so Tuesday, we'll take it on Tuesday, and then we'll correct it on Wednesday. No? Everybody has to stay here. Cancel work. Forget your other classes. Yeah. Okay, it's the 5th. It's on everything, the whole year. Yeah. I think it's about 18 pages long. It'll take the hour to take the test. Study your past tests. That's one of the things you want to do. And then study the information since your last test. Because I'll have that on this test. So this test includes the information on the last part. And then it includes the whole year. And there's not a lot of questions from it. Basically what I did to make up the test is I picked out some of the questions from the previous tests. I made up a few new ones. But most of them are just from previous tests. And then I made up, and then the areas since the last test, that's new. And then I even pull a few questions out of just reading. I think it's largely reading out of the book of Mark, just reading it. The last chapter, a couple chapters, I just put some information down from there. So that's the test. Simple, easy test. 9,000 questions on it. It's a good test. You deserve a good test in this class after working the whole year. This test, I execute you if there's any arguments in class on the test. I bring a squad outside, and they've got M16s, and they just stand out there, four of them. And if there's any problems, I just walk you out there. And enough of this torture. Matthew chapter 24. We're following Jesus' teaching on the end times to his four disciples as they were on the Mount of Olives outside of Jerusalem. Matthew chapter 24, we're down to verse 28. Kind of an interesting verse. It says, "For wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together." Now it appears to reach down to the second coming. Verse 27 is the rapture. Verse 28 appears to be the second coming. It's something that's very apparent. And the parallel scriptures in the Bible, in the Old Testament, and in the book of Revelation, that speak of the birds feeding upon the birds of prey, feeding upon dead carcasses, points to the Battle of Armageddon. It was prefigured in 70 AD. And therefore, this appears to be a statement concluding the signs to watch for as to when you flee. And we see the same type of scenario of the birds coming and eating upon the flesh in Ezekiel 39:4-5. There it refers to the Battle of Armageddon. And Jeremiah 34, verses 18 through 20. And so it does there. And in the second coming of Christ, when he promptly concludes that war, and the Battle of Armageddon, of course, extends all the way down into Jerusalem. In fact, you could actually call it a different war there, but we see there that that's what happens again. There are so many slain that the birds come and feed upon their flesh. In Revelation 19, verses 17 and 18. And then right after this, verses 29 to 31 are clearly the second coming. It says, immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. The elect here refers to the Israelites scattered around the world. And they're gathered together and brought to Jerusalem at the beginning of the millennium. This is clearly seen in several prophecies in the Old Testament. Among them, Isaiah 66 and verse 20. After the Battle of Armageddon and after the Second Coming, Jesus actually has those that were there at Jerusalem and saw the power of God go throughout the earth and gather in Israel. Bring them back into Palestine, because that's where they're all going to live. That's where they're all going to stay. And so that's the elect, and that happens after Christ comes in the Second Coming. And then verses 32 to 35... Jesus begins to warn them about being watchful because of the swiftness of all these occurrences. Now learn a parable of the fig tree. When his branch is yet tender and puts forth leaves, ye know that summer is nigh. So likewise ye, when ye shall see all these things, know that it is near, even at the doors. Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall not pass away. So it will be even as God has said. Now the fig tree is used. That's interesting. Because the fig tree is a type of Israel. And so this is the scripture that people refer to when they say that this generation is probably begun when Israel becomes a nation. Because that's when she first puts forth her leaves. When there's a sign of life. It's the fig tree. So when you see the nation of Israel come back into a nation, start putting forth leaves, then you will know that it's going to happen quickly. It's going to happen fast because summer is nigh. And summer, by the way, is the time of tribulation. Summer for us is vacation. I mean, not maybe vacation, but it's the time of, you know, sunshine and fun and all of that. For them, summer was the time of tribulation. Spring was a time of blessing. Summer was a time of tribulation. And so Jesus is saying, when you see the nation of Israel start putting forth leaves, then you know the tribulation is soon to be. And these things are going to come to pass. So that's why people say that that generation very possibly is to be numbered from when Israel became a nation. Well, that's 1948. Well, how long is a generation? How long is a generation? See? Interesting, that's the year that I was... better not tell you. Well, that's the year I was born. 1948. Way back in the Ancient of Days. And that's not that long ago. John. You too, huh? So, I don't know. Is my generation up yet or am I over yet? I don't know. I still seem to be kicking, you know. I feel like it's just beginning. So, what's a generation? I don't know. In Bible prophecy, there's a real question. It goes all the way from 30 years to 100 years. It's generally 40 to 70. That's where you'll see the most saying it, that a generation from 40 to 70 years. It talks about 70 years in the Scripture as being the years of a king, and which seems to point to a time of a generation. A king, you know, going through his generation. So maybe it's 70 years. Well, if it's 70 years... But see, you know, oftentimes God doesn't deal with that way. He'll deal with it with in other methods, and his timing is different than man's timing. His timing refers to what has actually happened. Like if you've heard Don preach on the 70 weeks of Daniel, it was a time clock system where God was only marking the time when they were doing what he had said they should be doing and what he said in the prophecy they would be doing. And that's rebuilding the city of Jerusalem. And when they weren't working on that, and they weren't part of that, but they were backslidden and turned from it, the time clock stopped. But as soon as they were doing it, then it'd start up again, and he'd count off 69 weeks that way until the coming of the Messiah. So anyway, the point is that when it starts coming, it's going to come fast. Things will change fast. There'll be a lot of shock, you know, going around. Now, I don't know how you have viewed the last 2 years, but for me, it's been a whirlwind. I mean, we have just been moving. Every week is big things happening. I mean, it's like, you know, before, in 6 months, the things that would happen now are happening in a week.
That's right.
And just being challenged and goaded and, you know, those that are pressing into God and everybody, you know, I mean, wherever we're all at, we're all there. And people are having different types of experiences and feelings about all that. But the point is that things are moving quickly. And you can tell that God is wanting us to really come into a security in Him like never before. A real foundation of faith and trust and submission like never before. I mean, and we're really being brought together. He's saying, sheep, close ranks. Close ranks. And I'll tell you, and God is, there's a lot to be done. God's really serious about what He wants accomplished. And He wants the families built together strongly and powerfully. I mean, there's a lot yet that God has got to do. He wants there to be real union and fellowship in the families and the marriages. And He wants real, but in an open association of love and not all the drawing together in isolation. See? And so there's just a lot of work to be done yet, but boy, it's sure going fast. Now, some may not think that way, but I'll tell you, you get in the school and it goes fast. If you're not in the school yet, then it may not seem like it's going fast. But if you're enrolled, it's going fast. A lot of changes, a lot of development. And you all know what I'm talking about. And then, the end of the chapter, verses 36 to 51, Jesus then emphasizes the overall need for preparation. Get ready, get ready, get ready, get ready. That's the idea. Get ready and be watchful. That's the main point. Verse 36, but of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. In the parallel passage, even he says, not even the Son of Man does not know the day when Jesus will come again. It's interesting the angels are not omniscient, and it's interesting that the Son of Man aren't omniscient. But only as God gives the revelation. Because, see, Jesus Christ as man does not live in the future. Only the eternal Spirit of God does. And so that's what we see being stated here. Verse 37. But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered into the ark. And knew not until the flood came and took them all away, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. Then shall two be in the field, and one shall be taken and the other left. Two women shall be grinding at the mill, the one shall be taken and the other left. So we see here, basically, that it says in the days of Noah. Now what's that like? Well, the idea is that all things continue as they always did. They continue in their marrying, their giving in marriage. There's no big changes. See, everything just kind of continues along. And then it hit them unawares. In 2 Peter 3, verses 3 and 4, it says that people accuse the Christians, and they're scoffers, and they're walking in their own lusts, and they're saying that all things continue from the beginning. Where's the promise of His coming? You guys are saying all these big cataclysms. We don't see it. And it's going to hit them all of a sudden. Now, the main benefit here is for the believer. And therefore, what he is talking about largely is referring to the rapture. He's not telling the ungodly and the unsaved to be ready for the second coming. And he's not telling the saved to be ready for the second coming. Because at the second coming, there's no saved left. So he's telling the Christians to get ready for the rapture. is for the believer. In Luke 21:36, watch and pray always that you may gain full strength, and that that day might not come upon you unawares. And that you might be gaining full strength and escape out of all these things that shall come as a snare upon all them on the face of the earth. We want to escape out of those things. We've got to be ready and watchful. Verse 42, watch therefore, for you know not what hour your Lord doth come. But know this, that if the good man of the house had known in what watch the thief would come, he would have watched and would not have suffered his house to be broken up. Therefore be ye also ready, for in such an hour as ye think not, the Son of Man comes. Who then is a faithful and wise servant, whom his Lord hath made ruler over his household to give them meat in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall find so doing. Verily I say unto you, that he shall make him ruler over all his goods. So we see here that just as an undesirable, and here it's an undesirable, but also an unannounced entrance of a thief. You've got to be ready at all times so that they will not come. And if they ever come, then you can stop them. And if he'd have known, he would have watched and would not have allowed his house to be broken up. Therefore, we are to be also ready, for we not know when the Son of Man comes. And see, if we're not ready, our house will be broken up. And we'll miss the rapture. And we'll enter into great tribulation such as the world has never seen. So also here. Verse 49. And shall begin to smite, says, well, verse 48. But and if that evil servant shall say in his heart, my Lord delays his coming, and shall begin to smite his fellow servants and to eat and drink with a drunken, the Lord of that servant shall come in a day when he looks not for him, and in an hour when he is not aware of, and shall cut him asunder, and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites, there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. We see that the readiness here is the readiness of a submissive heart. It's a submissive heart and a spiritual sensitivity. Because if we're uncaring when the Lord comes, then guess what else we're going to be uncaring about? We'll be uncaring about our brethren. You see, if your heart is uncaring about the Lord's coming, that attitude will spread to everything else you do. And pretty soon you'll be uncaring about your brethren. But if you care about the Lord's coming and being prepared for Him, you'll also be caring about your brethren and how you relate to them. See, it's really true. You can't escape your own heart. How you relate towards your brethren is a visible representation of how you're feeling towards God. Here we see the person became selfish and proud, an evil heart of slothfulness, an evil heart of uncaring, self-satisfied. Now, if the Lord finds him that way and he comes and he's not ready, he shall cut him asunder, it says in verse 51. Really strong, because it literally means cut in two. He'll cut him in two. That's kind of a horrible death. Be cut in two. And this is the judgment of breaking the covenant. In Genesis 15, 9 and 10, when Abraham made covenant with God, he cut the animals in two. Laid the parts on either side and walked in the midst. And you know, basically when they did that, you know what they were saying? They were saying that let us be as these animals if we break this covenant. And so God is basically saying here, he broke the covenant, so he's going to get cut in two. Okay, then to chapter 25. Yes? Yeah, it wouldn't necessarily be referring to the lake of fire here. A weeping and gnashing of teeth could be because of a missing. You know, it could be because of a missing. Although here, I think in general, he's called an evil servant. His portion is given with the hypocrites. And there is an outer darkness. And there is a total and final destruction. And so we see this again and again when Jesus brought forth these parables. We'll see this again in chapter 25. He's not making all the fine distinctions. He's not. He's just basically pointing out, you make it or you don't. You make it or you don't. And he's not giving us, you know, as it were, a second chance idea. Because of our understanding of the rapture and of the great tribulation, we can, you know, we see there almost the development of a second idea, a second chance. We see the development of the idea of a second chance, as it were. That there are those that did not prepare and therefore were not counted, they did not gain enough strength to escape out of it, and they went into it. Here he's not giving that idea. He's just saying you make it or you don't. Which points out something. It may point out the fact that if the heart has fallen into such a level where they just beat the servants and they're taking advantage of their position, that they really will lose their soul. They will not be able to make it in the Great Tribulation. No way. They'll lose it. The ones that will make it in the Great Tribulation are those that have loved the Lord, have served Him, but they have not come into that place of brideship relationship. And they'll counsel, you know, although there's a pride and a self-sufficiency there, in all appearances, it appears that the Christians that go into the tribulation, they're ones that they want to serve God, but they're, because of the various deceptions, they feel self-sufficient. They feel rich. They feel in need of nothing. There's a real self-sufficiency. And because of that, they've got to buy gold tried in fire. They've got to get gold that's been burned out, you know. That's the only way they're going to make it in the Great Tribulation. But here it's just viewing those that just will not be ready at all. They're not even in that good a place. Their heart is set against the servants. And when the Lord comes, they are cut in two. And it's basically sort of kind of including both the rapture and the great tribulation and the whole judgment on Christianity all in one. See, you find that in Jesus' teaching here. He is not specifically dividing out each detail of the end time events. He's not doing that. He's giving a broad perspective of get ready or you won't make it. That's the basic perspective that he's getting. So my conclusion to all that is that weeping and gnashing of teeth is a lake of fire. It wouldn't necessarily have to be, though. I mean, it would depend on the context, but here I think it is. Because he's cut in two. He's apportioned with the hypocrites. There's weeping and gnashing of teeth. He's out. He missed it. It's over. It's done for him. He's an evil servant. So. Okay, chapter 25 now. We have the parable of the 10 virgins in verses 1 through 13. Now again, you know, we look deeper into it for deeper meaning, but I want you to first just stand back and look at the whole parable and just see the general thrust of it. And that again, Jesus is not just taking specifics and trying to give you all the time keys and all the relationships of the end time events. He's just not doing that. He's basically talking about those that make it and those that don't. Two classes. He's not talking about three classes. Those that go in the rapture, those that go through the tribulation, and then those that don't make it. He's talking about two classes. Those that make it and those that don't. Then shall the kingdom of heaven be likened unto 10 virgins, which took their lamps and went forth to meet the bridegroom. Now remember, the whole context is be prepared. These virgins represent saints. They're undefiled. Notice there's 10 of them. That refers to the fullness in this world. So it's referring to all the saints. All the saints are undefiled. Now even the Corinthians that were carnal, they were undefiled, as it were. They were virgins. Because they were sanctified. The Lord calls them that through Paul. Sanctified. Verse 2. And 5 of them were wise, and 5 were foolish. And they that were foolish took their lamps and took no oil with them. You know, a Christian can be foolish. He's got a lamp, but he's not relying on his oil. He hasn't had forethought enough, foresight enough, to be relying on that oil. He's just got a lamp, and he's just happy to have a lamp, and he's just kind of around, unwise. He's foolish. But the wise took oil in their vessels with their lamps. Verse 5, while the bridegroom tarried, they all slumbered and slept. You know, Jesus seems to tarry. So many have said that he'll come any time that many have now grown weary. For years and years and years, it's been thought that Jesus would come at any time. And many felt like the First World War was the end of it. That was the end of it. That was the Battle of Armageddon. They'd never seen like anything like it in the history of the whole world. They'd had the Civil War before that. They'd had all kinds of strifes and wars around the world, and that was it. The First World War was the end of all wars. That was going to be when Jesus Christ comes back, usher it all in, see? But it didn't happen then. So then there's all these other wars that happened. And then the Second World War. Now that's got to be it. It's got to be the end, you know? Although there wasn't as much of a spiritual interpretation of that then. But now we've come to learn that, you know, there's other things that yet have to be fulfilled. And so clear searching of prophecy lets you know that it isn't just that Jesus can come at any minute. There's other things that have to happen yet. First, that man of lawlessness must be revealed. And the great falling away must occur first, before that day. And so there's things yet to happen. And in order for him to be revealed, there's going to be a world government. So many, though, feel like he tarries. And he does. The Lord tarries. It's always been that way. He's going to come tomorrow, you all know. He called you to ministry, so you want to start tomorrow. Pastor Don got a call in the ministry. Took over 20 years before he stepped into it. Now, that's a man that was really prepared. He was more prepared by the time he was out of Bible college than most all of us. 20 more years. So it seems like the Lord tarries sometimes. And when they did, they all nodded and drowsed. Now, that's exactly what's happening to the church. The saints of God, seems like everybody is affected some way or another. But evidently, even in this parable, there is allowance made for those that didn't drowse. Because there's criers, there's watchmen that come, and they cry and they say, make ready, here he comes. And in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verses 4 through 8, we see that there are some that will not drowse. There are certain watchmen that will not give peace to the Lord until he established Jerusalem in the earth. Verse 6. And at midnight there was a cry made. You know what's at midnight? Darkness. I mean, it's really dark at midnight. It's supposedly the darkest hour at midnight. That's when the sun is at the furthest extremity from where you are. And so it's darkness at midnight. And there was a cry made. Behold, the bridegroom cometh. Go ye out to meet him. And so in the Greek, the cry simply occurred. But the crier, in Revelation 22 and verse 17, it says, the Spirit and the bride say, come. The Spirit and the bride, they say, come. Now in this parable, though, the virgins are the ones that meet the bridegroom. In other parables or in other images, it's the man-child that is caught up to God. So, you know, each parable has its own image. And here it's just simply viewing two classes of Christians, the wise and the unwise. Those that make it and those that don't. That's the basic view of this parable. Those that make it and those that don't. The wise and the foolish. And you can see that there is a great apostasy. Because the foolish aren't going to make it. They were Christians. They were virgins. But they're not going to make it. There's going to be a great falling away in these last days. Yes?
Mark, do you think that the ones who will fall away will be Christians, and then the great harvest, those people may be the ones that don't know anything about Christianity? You know, like, just kids that never were brought up on the church and whatnot. And the great apostasy might be the denominational church.
Yeah, how that overlap? It'll probably be an overlapping type thing. At the same time that many are backsliding and falling away, there may be others getting saved. And we know that the gospel will be preaching to all the world. And so it's kind of it's difficult to know. We know that the man-child ministry is not going to be a long one. It's going to be a short ministry. And during that time, there's going to be a great harvest. And as God says, and in that first month, both the early and the latter rain are going to occur. And see, that's just before the harvest. And so he's going to pour out a deluge like crazy, and they're going to have to gather like crazy, and the sowers are going to overtake the reapers. I mean, there's going to be so much going on. God is just going to be saving souls right and left. There's just going to be a great harvest. And I tell you, even right now, there's a great harvest occurring in the world. America, we're kind of in a... We're in a real scary state. Really, we are. America's in a scary place. There's a kind of a deadness. There's a lot of preaching, a lot of things going on, but there's an Antichrist spirit that's really building. And we're not repenting. America is not repenting. There's a hardness, a coldness that has come into America, and I'll tell you, it's hard to shake. And in all our fires, we're starting to get to, you know, some more sensitivities, but hey, you know, there's a dullness. There's a dullness, and there's a lack of power. And God is preaching. He's trying to pierce through, but I don't know. I was talking with somebody last night about even John's sermon yesterday morning. And I was so revelatory. I mean, God is really digging deep. God is digging deep. The revelation was so clear and so deep. But I tell you, you could just tell it was dullness. We were having a hard time getting it. And that's a tape that probably many of us are going to want to listen to again and again, you know. And get a hold of that best that we can. Because when you have a people that have been in the way for a long time, they tend to get in the way, you know. And when Jesus comes, He has a hard time breaking through them. And see, we're kind of in that sort of a state. Jesus wants to do a new work. And it's been super hard on those that have been in the way. But those that are open to the Spirit of God and willing to move, or the young, boy, they can move right in, you know. They can partake of it. But those that have gotten engaged in the Christianity, you know, the works, and they've got their ideas, it's so hard to break out of that because it's unsettling. It's really unsettling. And it really is a test on those that will walk in righteousness, you know. It's really a test for everybody to take their own responsibility before God and live righteously and holy before God. And that's a scary thing to let happen. You don't want to let it happen because you don't want people to make mistakes. And so what have we done? We've had law Christianity. We've kept Hagar around. And we've let Ishmael, we've applauded him. And God says, I'm done with it. I want Isaac. I want love marriages. I want love relationships. I want love foundation. I want love fellowship. And I don't want to pervert it. But I got to give it to you before you're going to be able to purify it and keep it from perversion. And in the midst of it, the devil's going to try to get you to pervert it. But it's my heart, and I've got to have you honor my heart as to what I want to do. As to what I want to do. It's interesting that in the revival under Martin Luther, there was just a rash of carnality that was swept into the church because they had all this law under Catholicism. When all of a sudden they're saved by grace, they just slip right into Romans 5 there where it says, well, we're sin about it. Grace is much more superabound, so let's sin. And all of a sudden, there wasn't the bondages and the clamps of the Catholic Church on them, and there was a whole slipping into carnality. Does that disprove Luther's thesis? Does that disprove his revelation that we are justified by grace through faith? Not at all. Not at all. It just was now they had to be tested. They'd been under the bondage, see? And they needed to grow and to develop. It's not like, you know, we're all living in some horrible bondage. It's just that under systems of the lack of the moving of the power of God's Spirit and the lack of that intense love in the church, we have not been able to. You know, it's nobody's fault, really. We just have not been tested or proven or had opportunity and therefore been able to develop in those realms that we need so desperately. Now, some have to more or less extents. You know, really. Everybody has to one extent or another, somewhat. And to their help or hindrance, you know, in the move. But the point that I'm getting at, I guess, I'm not sure what the point is. I'm trying to get back to my original point. Oh yeah, back to America. Yeah. Okay. still not sure what the point is. Anyway, I think I went on about 9 tangents. I'm out so far on the limb, I think it broke. So let's just go, let's climb back to the trunk. I was roofing one time with a sweet brother. We were on this house. And all of a sudden, you know, I was roofing on the other side of the house, and all of a sudden, here I come walking up the ladder, and he looks at me, because I hadn't walked across the house and come up the ladder. I've gone down the ladder, and here I come up the ladder, and he wonders, where in the world did you come from? Did you fly away, or what did you do? I got so far out on the limb broke. I was hanging over the edge of the house. I mean, you get real relaxed with heights and everything. I was laying, my leg was hanging over the edge of the house. I just relaxed, just pounding away, and I just slipped off the house. Luckily, it was a rambler, so it was only one height, and all of a sudden, and there I was. So I walked around that side of the house walking. Well, that's what I've just done again. It's so relaxed in this class, just slipped off the roof. Luckily, it was grass below. Okay. So, the cry at midnight, the bridegroom cometh, go ye out to meet him. Then all those virgins arose and trimmed their lamps. Now see, when you slumber and sleep, the lamps keep burning, and that little wick gets black and charred and curls over. So to trim it, you have to pull the wick out, snip off the black part, you know, trim it off, try to keep the light burning. So you trip it off little, so that it can get back down into the burning on the good flax part. So they trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said unto the wise, give us of your oil, for our lamps are gone out. And literally here, it's more of the idea of our flickering. In other words, there's not enough. As they pulled that wick out, their lamps, and in order to trim them, their lamps are just on their last. And so when the Lord calls, they have just a smidget of oil left, and it's definitely not enough. For by the time they get out to the bridegroom, it will be out. It'll be over. And so by the time they've slumbered and slept, they've lost almost all of their oil. It's almost all gone. Very little left. But the wise answered, saying, not so, lest there be not enough for us and you. But go ye rather to them that sell and buy for yourselves. And while they went to buy, the bridegroom came. Because they were not prepared, they could not be with the bridegroom. They had to go elsewhere and they had to buy. And they cannot rely on other men either. This is a good example of personal responsibility. Now we might say, well, those wise, they were sure selfish. Look how selfish those wise people were. Why didn't they give them some of their oil? Shame on them. Shame on them. You know, and we're learning that there is a false responsibility that the devil has tried to put upon the church that keeps people from growing. We're falsely responsible for somebody, and you know what we end up doing? Babying them. And we never give them the opportunity to grow themselves. We keep trying to rush in at their problems. And so they learn to cry louder, and you learn to take care of more. And the end result is you both die. You need to step back and say, kiddo, you got to walk on your own. I love you, and I'll tell you what to do, but you got to do it. And, you know, manifest that love and that care and that patience. And that's what they had to do. We cannot rely on other men. If you look to others, you'll both grow weary. If they allow you to falsely obligate them, they will grow weary. God has got to separate the wise from the foolish. He's got to. And He gives opportunity. He's given opportunity in this move. Do you see these things, how they apply? See how God is doing this? In verse 9 here, it says, not so, lest there be not enough for us and you, but go ye rather to them that sell and buy. Revelation chapter 3 and verse 18. Go, buy for yourselves gold tried in the fire, see? They've got to go. They've got to get it. And it's going to cost them. Verse 10. And while they went to buy, the bridegroom came, and they that were ready went in with him to the marriage, and the door was shut. The door was shut. In Revelation 3 and verse 7. The Philadelphia church age, the Lord says, I am he that openeth and no man shutteth. And I am he that shuts and no man opens. And that's exactly what you see happening in the Philadelphia church age. There are open doors of ministry and opportunity and salvation that nobody's going to stop. God is going to accomplish it. And there is also a time when the door is shut and nobody's going to open it. And that's it. It's over. And that's to the Philadelphia church age. Afterward came also the other virgins, saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. But he answered and said, Verily I say unto you, I know you not. Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour wherein the Son of Man cometh. Now this ending is not the way you and I would have made it. Because we would have had these be the tribulation saints, and they would have made it later, buying, you know, gold, but they'd have had a lesser place. That's how we would have ended the story. Jesus didn't end it that way. He says, I know you not. The perfect tense. In other words, I have not known you, and I do not know you now. And it's the same idea we saw in Matthew 7, verse 23, of those who don't get saved. In Revelation chapter 17 and verse 8, And the beast that thou sawest was and is not, shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition, and they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life and the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. They shall wonder, their names are not written. I have not known you. They're not written. So who are these virgins? Well, the parable is speaking of the hearts of those who will prepare and of those who won't prepare. And all the other qualifications are not given. So this is not a parable that is laying out all the specific aspects of the end times. We can pull principles from it, and we can pull application to the saints of the end of time. But it's talking about those who do make it and about those who don't make it. It's talking about those who are saved and not those who aren't. And it's interesting, though, that they all start out as virgins. And so it's a description of the great apostasy. In Hebrews 10, 38 and 39, we see the same idea of either those that enter into wrath or those that enter into salvation. Now the just shall live by faith. But if any man draw back, my soul shall have no pleasure in him. But we are not of them who draw back unto perdition, but of them that believe to the saving of the soul. So there are those that draw back unto what? Perdition. They don't make it. We also see this in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verses 4 through 9. But you, brethren, are not in darkness, that that day should overtake you as a thief. Ye are all the children of light and the children of the day. We are not of the night nor of darkness. Therefore let us not sleep as do others, but let us watch and be sober. For they that sleep, sleep in the night. Nay, they be drunken are drunken in the night. But let us who are of the day be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith and love, and for a helmet the hope of salvation. For God has not appointed us to wrath, but to obtain salvation by our Lord Jesus Christ. So it's either wrath or salvation. To be obtained. So it's either one or the other. So we've got the all these virgins slept and slumbered. And if you were to apply it to the end times, the more probable application is that the five wise are the tribulation saints who make it. The criers are the bride. The five foolish is the great apostasy. And that doesn't mean that half of all Christendom is going to backslide. It doesn't mean that. It's just pointing out the two classes. And 10 is the fullness of the world. And 5 is the number of grace. So to those that were wise, they received grace. So that is the view of this parable. Now, verses 14 through 30 is the giving of the talents. Now we saw an earlier similar parable. In Luke chapter 19, verses 11 through 28. And there were 10 servants, and they were each given a pound, which is a smaller sum. A pound is worth 100 denarius. A talent is worth 6,000 denarius. So that's 60 times more. 60 times more. That's 6,000% more. But here, in Luke 19, they were given the same amount. It was given to 10 servants. And it's probably, because it's the same to all of them, referring to that call and the gift of salvation that are given to all. Everyone has a call and the gift of salvation. But he must do business with his call. He must make his calling and election sure. And some do it with greater abundance, and some do it with lesser abundance. Some multiplied 10 times, some multiplied at 5. But we must do business till He comes in order to be prepared. Here in Matthew 14 through 30, it's a different parable. Here they are given different amounts of money. And a very large amount of money is given. It's a talent. It's the largest weight of money that there is, and it was worth 6,000 denarius. And it was given to each man according to his abilities, or according to his strength. In other words, he was given all that he could handle, and all that he was able to put to use. Some are able to put more to use than others. Some are able to put more to use than others, and they're given more. And we see a parallel to this in Romans chapter 12, verses 5 and 6. Romans 12, 5 and 6. So we being many are one body in Christ, and every one members one of another. Having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given to us, whether prophecy, let us prophesy according to the proportion of faith, and etc. Having gifts differing according to the grace that is given unto us. Okay, so let's start reading it. For the kingdom of heaven is as a man traveling into a far country, who called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods. And unto one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1. To every man according to his several ability, his personal ability. Now this word ability here is dunamis in the Greek. It is several or personal, a strength is what it would mean. And straightway took his journey. Then he that had received the 5 talents went and traded with the same and made them other 5 talents. Likewise he that had received 2, he also gained other 2. But he that had received 1 went and digged in the earth and hid his Lord's money. After a long time, the Lord of those servants comes and reckons with them. So he that had received 5 talents came and brought other 5 talents, saying, Lord, thou deliverest unto me 5 talents. Behold, I have gained beside them 5 talents more. His Lord said unto him, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I'll make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. He also that had received 2 talents came and said, Lord, thou deliverest unto me 2 talents. Behold, I have gained 2 other talents beside them. His Lord said unto him, well done, good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I'll make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. Now here we are viewing faithfulness according to our ability. And both of them were faithful. They both gained 100% return. And so they were rewarded according to their faithfulness, not according to their abilities. Notice that. They're rewarded according to their faithfulness, not according to their abilities. If you look at somebody and say, well, he's got a lot more talent than I've got, that is not the issue. If you are faithful with what you have, you can do better. If a third grader, a first grader, is faithful with trying to learn the alphabet, he has done better than a high schooler who is not faithful, though they know English excellent. They are doing better, even though they know a lot less. And so it is with us. See, knowledge puffs up. Knowledge is not the answer. It's your faithfulness with what you receive that's the answer. That's the key. All right. It's interesting. Saul did not have this revelation. When he saw David kill his 10,000s, he was jealous. We need to learn to not look after talent, but rather look to faithfulness. If Saul was faithful, he has a reason to be just as pleased as David, who was faithful. Now God had put more into David's hands. He slew his 10,000s. Saul, he slew his 1,000s. But he was faithful. If he was faithful and continued faithful, that was just as fine. When you get your eyes on the talents, you know, the amount, instead of the faithfulness, you make a grave mistake and you'll bring yourself into despising what you yourself have. You lose what you've got. Verse 24, then he which had received the 1 talent came and said, Lord, I knew thee that thou art a hard man, reaping where thou hast not sown, and gathering where thou hast not strawed. And I was afraid and went and hid thy talent in the earth. Lo, there thou hast, that is thine. And the Lord called him, you wicked and slothful servant. Now in verse 24, is this a true assessment of God? Now in verse 26, the Lord answered and said unto him, thou wicked and slothful servant, thou knewest that I reap where I sowed not, and gather where I have not strawed. Does God reap where he sows not? Does God gather where he has not strawed? In Luke 19 and verse 22, in that parable, listen to what the master said here. Luke 19:22. And he saith unto him, out of thine own mouth will I judge thee, thou wicked servant. Thou knewest that I was an austere man, taking up that I laid not down, and reaping that I did not sow. You knew that? Well, why didn't you at least take some of the money and turn it in? Now, some say that God is agreeing. Most agree that he is not agreeing. And basically, he's just judging the man by saying, you judge yourself, because if I really am that way, and you at least should have put it into the bankers and gotten some interest out of it. That's the least you should have done with that money. If you knew that that's the way that I was. Now, austere means sharp, harsh, strict, even churlish. And this is a sinner's view of God. It is. And I hate to say it, but a lot of Christians too. We don't really realize how wonderful Jesus is. Especially those that have been under legalism. I know for myself, I have probably wept the most and rejoiced the most over the revelations of how sweet Jesus is. The revelation and the understanding of how good God is, that has impacted me probably more than anything else I've experienced in this world. Just finding the heart of God, what He's really like. Getting to release from all that other stuff, because we've been really hard on ourselves. We've had the wrong attitude about God. And a lot of us have. Most commentators feel that the Lord is simply saying, well, if you thought that I was that way, then that's all the more reason to at least have put my money to the lenders. In other words, if you think I'm that much in sovereign control, well then if I'm that much in sovereign control, you had better obey at least in the simplest way. Now, the truths are this. Number one, God is in control. He really is. He does own all things. He does. He owns everything. But that should drive us to obedience. This servant disobeyed because God said, do business with the money. God also does sow, though, and He also does scatter abroad because of His goodness. This strad, it means to winnow. It refers to winnowing. Let me look back at what I'm talking about. I don't know if you're with me on this. In verse 24, thou reaping where thou hast not sown. And God can reap anything He wants. He owns the whole world. You know, a king can go out across the countryside and he can reap anybody's field he wants to. Doesn't matter who's sown it. Because he's king. And he can gather where he has not himself winnowed. He can just go in there and fill his buckets full of clean grain, even though he's not the one that winnowed it. But I'm telling you, God also has sown. And he sows. And he goes out and he's helped us do more sowing than we'll ever realize. And he's also gone out there and he has winnowed. And so here are some judgments. Boy, I'm just right in the middle of this thing. I'll have to let it go. Pick it up tomorrow. We're going to be ready. Yes. Going to be ready. Glory, glory, glory to God.